I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The last presidential primary is today in Washington, D.C. It's been a long, fascinating, sometimes contentious, substantive, and surprising campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, in many ways because of Bernie Sanders. The Democratic Socialist from Vermont announced his run a year ago and was seen by pundits and much of the press as a fringe candidate. But not to the millions who voted for him and connected with his message of revolution and his calls for financial and campaign finance reform, free higher education, increasing the minimum wage, reducing income inequality, and rethinking trade deals. But Clinton won more votes, more delegates, and superdelegates, and held a victory celebration last week. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are apparently meeting today. He has promised to take his campaign here to Philadelphia for the Democratic National Convention. We asked Katrina Vandenhoevel to join us on Radio Times to talk about the progressive movement and Bernie Sanders. She is the publisher and editor of The Nation. The Nation endorsed Bernie Sanders for president, and she writes a weekly column for The Washington Post, a web column for The Washington Post, and her blog appears at thenation.com. And Katrina Vandenhoevel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been a long time.
Thank you, Marty. Very good to be back.
Nice to have you with us. And I do want to talk about the campaign, but I do want to begin with the massacre in Orlando, the shooting at Pulse nightclub, 49 dead. It's clear 48 hours later there are no easy answers to the motivation of Omar Mateen. But I'm just curious about what you have been thinking about in the last 48 hours.
I've been thinking about the bedrock values of this country, of love, solidarity, of how we are better when we stand together versus hate, gun violence, terror. I think of the four freedoms which a president many years ago, Franklin Roosevelt, enunciated. Freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, and freedom of worship. Those values define us. They strengthen us. We can either be defined by this terror act. It can destroy us or it can strengthen us, resilience. But we must also understand that in this country, what often happens, and it's the 15th mass shooting since President Obama came to office, you could feel his war weariness as he stood at that podium on Sunday. But the victims were not yet buried before the horror became grist for our poisonous and polarized politics. You know, this is Pride Month, and so the values of solidarity and love, as my colleague Richard Kim at thenation.com wrote on Sunday, this club in many ways was a sanctuary for many. It was violated by someone who was mad and angry and who had a military weapon, which is part of course, the real problem. No law will stop all gun crimes, but smart laws will reduce the chance that someone like that would put a community at the greatest risk. So, you know, Donald Trump, you know, Marty, it's something. I mean, we have a mainstream candidate who is essentially normalizing bigotry. He made no distinction yesterday in his so-called pivot teleprompter speech between mainstream Muslims and Islamist terrorists. And I'm struck that, you know, the New York Times today, an eminent newspaper, in its coverage of that speech, the reporter wrote, he repeatedly stretched facts. No, Donald Trump lied, and I don't think our media, our culture, our politics has been able to cope with a demagogue who is abusing so many of the freedoms that make this country great. And finally, I'd say, you know, a lot of people talk about a moment of silence at times like this. My colleague John Nichols at TheNation.com wrote yesterday, citing a wonderful Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan, a gay Democrat. He said, no, what Mitch McConnell, a close ally of the NRA, when he says we need another moment of silence, Mark Pocan says what is needed is a moment of action. Inaction, explained Mark Pocan, disrespects the lives of the people who were killed not just yesterday but every day by gun violence. There may be blood in the streets, but if Congress continues to fail to act, we will have blood on our hands.
I want to pick up on several things. And as I said, and I do want to also talk about the nomination of the race for the White House on the Democratic side. Donald Trump seemed to sort of vaguely make reference to the fact that perhaps the president somehow was sympathetic to Omar Mateen or the radical haters who carry out effects like this or events like this. And I'd just like to get your response to that.
Well, you know, we've seen over the course of the last years a Republican Party, Marty, without Donald Trump at its head, but a Republican Party that has worked more assiduously to delegitimize President Obama than to pass legislation that would improve the condition of people's lives. I think what we see with Donald Trump is frightening because it's kind of the normalization, the bellowing, the shouting of ideas that have been within the Republican Party, a dog whistle racism, part of its Southern strategy going back to when Ronald Reagan announced his candidacy in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the site of the killings of three freedom fighters in the 60s, states' rights. The only heartening thing about what we see in Donald Trump's candidacy is I think many people inside the Republican Party have gotten how they've been scammed for years by a Republican establishment, which has promised to improve the conditions of people's lives, lives which have been lost to stagnating wages, factories leaving this country due to corporate-written trade deals, and then just write tax breaks for the very richest. And so I think people have woken up to that. The problem is that Donald Trump, like so many right-wing, ethnic, nationalist populists across the globe, he's not alone, is playing on people's fear, on their anxieties, and doing so with a very bigoted framework. And it's been at the heart of the Republican Party, many of what he steps he takes, but we haven't seen it as plainly, as normalized, as vulgar. And he is a master manipulator of the media. I sometimes wonder why the media, why do we cover every, it seems like every tweet? Is that really in the public interest? I mean, don't we want to put it in context, frame it? It's part of the ricocheting nano-speed media. But it certainly seems like Donald Trump, though maybe not created by certain parts of the media, particularly cable, has been, you know, nurtured and can't put aside, Marty, the money so many media companies have made on Donald Trump in this last year. Remember last summer, just you mentioned Bernie Sanders. You know, I think much of the media did as much as it could to write off, marginalize Bernie Sanders' candidacy, even while he was attracting thousands of people to rallies across the country. At the same time last August, I remember last hot August, it was wall-to-wall coverage on cable of Donald Trump's rallies, wall-to-wall. So there is a bit of a Frankenstein relationship with the media in terms of enabling, if not creating, Donald Trump.
Do you think Donald Trump can become president of the United States?
Never say never. You know, I don't know. I would be wrong. I have humility in trying to understand how this act of terror and hate will play out, as I said, in our polarized, poisonous politics. I think he has a narrow path to victory among a white working class that is rightly angered, as I said earlier, by two mainstream political parties which have not listened to them. I do think Bernie Sanders represented a wing of the Democratic Party which knew which side it was on and stood on the side of working people who feel shafted. I think Donald Trump is doing very best to be a sore winner and alienating independents, alienating minorities in this country, a vast demographic which will only grow in support. So one could argue that if he even if he won, it's political suicide for the Republicans to continue down the path Donald Trump is following, even while, you know, many Republicans hope he will be, quote, civilized or tamed by a teleprompter and other factors. And I think women become very important, Marty. I think he has shown, if not full-out misogyny, but he's been sexist. I mean, he's a strange, vulgar, brash kind of sexism, which he thinks isn't sexism, but I think he's alienated women. And of course, his policies, you know, it's not just choice, and he's all wobbly on that. Mm-hmm. And it's not just supporting Planned Parenthood, but it's about, you know, building an economy that works for women, for working women. And I think I do think Hillary Clinton speaks clearly and forcefully on that and has been moved by Bernie Sanders to take positions such as, you know, the issues on health care, on moving toward a 15 minimum wage, paid sick days, family paid leave. Those are vital for millions of women and families across this country. And I don't think Donald Trump has a clue because he's lived a fairly New York penthouse privileged life, and he doesn't seem to care about those issues. And he, you know, I think he's alienating, as I said, a lot of people he will need to put together a coalition to win.
As we all know, Bernie Sanders talked a lot and eloquently about a revolution. Do you see the fact that Hillary Clinton seems to have all the votes and delegates and superdelegates she needs to be the nominee of the Democratic Party, that that's also a revolution for the first female president?
You know, the night she spoke after California and New Jersey, it was very moving. I thought, and this isn't to take away from her, but in the beginning of the campaign, Marty, she often in victory primary speeches would say, I. I think she also was moved by Bernie Sanders and by her own understanding to be more we. And that night she claimed victory. She put it in the context of women's fight for freedom and equality in this country. She spoke of standing on the shoulders of people like Shirley Chisholm, extraordinary black candidate who always was called unbossed and unbought, Shirley Chisholm, Geraldine Ferraro, Seneca Falls, the suffragettes. And in that context, it was a sense of this country making history and Hillary Clinton. And even those Bernie Sanders supporters who were disappointed had to respect that. Some of it is a little diminished, honestly, because Hillary Clinton,
is it
a
Clinton?
First. And, is it? I mean, there's a sense of having been, I think it's unfair in many ways, but a sense of having been on the political stage for more than two decades. But I don't like that. In the same way I find Trump and his attacks on Hillary Clinton around her allegations of her husband's sexual activities, I find that deeply sexist. You don't blame a woman for her husband's infidelities. And I think Hillary Clinton should stand on her own. It's tough because the Clintons have been such an overwhelming factor on the political scene. But one gives it to her. One has to. And I thought she framed it in important ways that appealed to millions of women who might not have supported her, I think. I mean, there is a problem generationally. It is striking how many young women. In fact, Bernie Sanders, you could argue, didn't win. And his revolution will go on. We could talk about it. But he markedly changed not only the direction of his party, I think the politics of this country, but moved a generation to the progressive left and engaged them in a politics which they had not been tuned into. And I think that is so vital, that they remain involved in different ways, whether it's through social movements, which were in some ways the untold story of this election, or running for office. I think Bernie Sanders could play an extraordinary role in recruiting and supporting progressive candidates running for Congress, running for state and city offices, even for school boards, which is so vital.
That's Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, editor and publisher of The Nation. We asked her to join us on Radio Times to talk about certainly what's been happening or what happened in Orlando, Florida, but more than that, to talk about the race for the White House on the Democratic side. The Nation endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And again, I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation. The Nation did endorse Bernie Sanders earlier this year. We're covering a whole host of political issues and news-related issues as well. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I wonder, too, Katrina, whether Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, their fight for the nomination did reveal some divisions within the Democratic Party. Yes, he did well with younger voters, younger women included, but there seemed to be a split among minority voters, whether they were African-Americans or Latinos or Latinas, that they seemed to reveal some kind of split within the Democratic Party. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party has been split for years. Let me just frame it in a different way and come back to your good question. I've seen it over these last few years, even before Bernie Sanders ran. And The Nation's been covering Bernie Sanders, by the way, for close on to 30 years. He was a co-founder of the Progressive Caucus, which is marking its 25th anniversary, about 75 progressive legislators in Congress who share Bernie Sanders' values, which, by the way, I was always worried as Bernie traveled the country, railing against a rigged system and those inside the system, that he was broad-brushing the fact that, in fact, they're allies. There are people inside Congress who share his values. So I'd say that the party has been split between what I'd call, before Bernie Sanders ran, the Warren wing, the Elizabeth Warren wing, or the Paul Wellstone wing, if your listeners remember the senator from Minnesota, who first coined the phrase, "I'm a member of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party," a line that Howard Dean later picked up. I think there's been a division between, to put it not crudely but briefly, a corporate wing of the Democratic Party and a more populist wing of the Democratic Party. And I think we've seen it in the trade deals I mentioned before, going back to NAFTA. Trade is going to play a huge role in this election. We saw it in Bernie Sanders' campaign. We see it in how Trump talks about it endlessly. So I think there's that. I think since Obama became president and the way Obama was elected, we see something called the rising American majority. That is the new demographic coalition. It's Latinos. It's young people. It's single women. It's African Americans. And it's very powerful. But it also needs to fuse with those white working class who may have found more of a place in that other wing. But I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren will play an important role in shaping the future. I don't know if she'll be a vice president, but I do think that Bernie Sanders' run showed that there is an ascendancy of a more populist progressive wing inside the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton was moved by it in this campaign. She's a smart politician. She's moved on certain issues. But I do think there is a split, and it will be interesting to see how it moves forward. I think Bernie Sanders becomes an important player. He will come back to the Senate. If it goes Democratic, he'll be chair of the Budget Committee. He will have a list of millions of those people who gave $27 on average, and he can drive issue campaigns and initiatives. And, you know, I think it's Elizabeth Warren, there are other senators, and I mentioned the Progressive Caucus. You could see a real inside as well as outside through social movements and other people running for office, a real battle for the soul of the Democratic Party.
It's so interesting because last week Elizabeth Warren came out, I would say, enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton, certainly getting behind her. And obviously she speaks to a lot of the Bernie Sanders supporters, I would think, that look to Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders to represent their political point of view. Bernie Sanders sounds like he's going to come to Philadelphia, bring his campaign to this city. What does he want?
Good question. Bernie Sanders ran the most successful insurgent campaign in modern history, 12 million votes, 23 states. Raised money to compete with the most powerful non-incumbent candidate in modern history. He would like to be respected. He would like his voice to be heard. The platform fights in your good city will be vital. Some say the platform's just a piece of paper. I disagree. I think it becomes a marker around which people can mobilize. He will want to see momentum on the key things that matter, the trade issue, some movement toward Medicare for all, universal health care, a move to 15 minimum wage. I think on racial justice, there will be unity about going bolder. He'd like to see some steps to democratize the rules and end to the unelected, unaccountable superdelegates. Those things matter, and I think those are discussions that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will have today. You know, Bernie Sanders has said from the very beginning, Marty, press often didn't cover it, that he would support the winner of the primaries, and he would do all he could to defeat Donald Trump. He can endorse and will endorse Hillary Clinton. I suspect he will travel in the fall to key states and work hard to defeat Donald Trump. He will not speak a lot about Hillary Clinton. He will speak about issues and the importance of defeating Donald Trump. He will do that, but in order to transfer the enthusiasm of his supporters to Hillary Clinton, I think she needs to listen. And I think her speech at the end of California, New Jersey, those primaries, you know, she spoke well about how Bernie Sanders had made this a better debate, a better campaign for the country and the party, and that she respected him and his supporters. But I think it's R-E-S-P-E-C-T, listening, and not listening to those in the Democratic Party establishment who continue to hector Bernie and his supporters about getting in line. That's not going to work. But I think there is a strategy and a path to pulling together. I think, you know, if the Sanders camp helps outline an agenda for defeating Donald Trump, if they play a role and the camp, Clinton camp embraces enough of it to indicate a break, you could see some real motion forward.
8 years ago, of course, Hillary Clinton was in the same position of Bernie Sanders, having lost to Barack Obama. It took her a couple of days, but then she really came out and endorsed Obama. She campaigned for him. She said to her supporters, it's time to get behind Barack Obama for president. But it sounds like you're saying that that's really Clinton's job. Bernie Sanders will continue with his message, but not necessarily tell his voters to go over to Hillary Clinton.
No, I think he will. I think he should be given an important keynote position at the convention. I'm sure Elizabeth Warren will be given one, if not an offer to get on the ticket. But he will say, support Hillary Clinton. He will say that and be prepared to work to defeat Trump. And he will say to those who say there's no real difference between Clinton and Trump that that's wrong. Trump has revealed himself to be a narcissistic, xenophobic hate monger, legitimizing bigotry, appointing Supreme Court justices. Let's not forget the role of the court here in this extraordinary election. And Hillary's not Bernie. She doesn't speak of breaking up the big banks. She doesn't speak of a rigged system. She doesn't speak of an oligarchy. But he will campaign against Donald Trump because he understands what his campaign did, Marty, was open up space for a more powerful progressive movement and demonstrate that a different kind of politics is possible. If Donald Trump becomes president, that space is, if not closed, diminished. He needs the space of defeating Donald Trump to continue to work for the issues, values he cares about. And in that, there will be some, you know, there will be a moving forward unified toward November.
When Bernie Sanders talks, and he still talks about revolution, what does he mean by that? And is there a revolution or even a stronger progressive movement without Bernie Sanders?
Oh, yeah. No, I think our cover story last week, Marty, was where do Bernie Sanders' grassroots troops go? And I think what's extraordinary about this election is that a lot of this was devolved through Facebook, through Slack. You had people for Bernie in communities around this country. Our correspondent is devoted to a beat to cover where does this revolution go? There's a group called Brand New Congress meeting in Memphis later this month, which is about electing a new Congress. There's a People's Summit in Chicago this coming weekend to talk about how do you occupy the Democratic Party. How do you lift up the issues Bernie Sanders amplified in this campaign? As I said, Bernie Sanders used his $27 average support list, that extraordinary list, to support three extraordinary progressive women, Zephyr Teach out in New York, Lucy Flores in Nevada, Pramila Jayapal in Washington State, and Tim Canova, who's running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the DNC in Florida. So he's, you know, understanding that it's not just him. If it's just him, That's not going to work. It may not be a movement because presidential campaigns have often fitfully moved toward movements. We saw with Jesse Jackson in 1988, Rainbow, Push Coalition. It's hard to build a movement out of a campaign, but you can inspire millions of others to do so. And I think that is one of the great possibilities of this campaign.
And that is Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, editor and publisher of The Nation. We are talking about Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, the race for the White House. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Katrina, I certainly know, I'm sure you know, plenty or some Bernie Sanders supporters who say, I will never, ever support or vote for Hillary Clinton. I see her as corrupt, the way that Donald Trump talks about corrupt Hillary Clinton. What do you say to those people?
I said, I sort of talked a little bit about it before, Marty, but first of all, I think it's probably 5% of Bernie Sanders supporters. I think you say to those who say there's no real difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, which is essentially why people might not vote for Clinton, that it's wrong. As I said, Trump has revealed himself to be what I said before. Hillary may not have Bernie Sanders' indignation, his revolutionary spirit, his understanding of what the Democratic Party or what a party should be for people in this country. On the other hand, there will be some who will vote for Jill Stein, the Green candidate. I believe in third parties if we have democratic reforms such as changing the ballot access. There is a move on to upend and abolish the Electoral College. I think this may be the last election. It may be the National Popular Vote Movement, people should check it out, launched by Jamie Raskin, who will be the next congressman from the 1st District in Maryland, who won the primaries a few weeks ago. It would give more power to states, which are essentially now, Marty, as you know, powerless. Every election, doesn't it seem like so-called battleground states dwindle? Used to be 18, then it's 14, then it's 6. So, you know, some will vote for Jill Stein, all power to a Green Party, but until we have those Democratic reforms, I fear that at the national level, third parties play a role in driving issues, but not in winning elections. The Libertarian Party this year may attract some younger voters. You know, it's about legalization of marijuana. It has a strong anti-intervention, anti-surveillance platform. But I think with so much at stake in this election, I think many will understand the importance of voting. And even with – I have my serious issue with Hillary Clinton is something that hasn't been raised enough in this campaign is her hawkishness in foreign policy and national security affairs. Bernie Sanders laid out some interesting ideas in the debates. At the platform committee, there will be a focus on trying to develop a more even-handed U.S. policy toward Israel, something he spoke of well in the Brooklyn, New York debate. But he needs, you know, we desperately need a new foreign policy that isn't about regime change politics, that isn't about use of military force too quickly, and that understands the dangers of a new Cold War, nuclear proliferation. And I fear that Hillary Clinton is signing up some neocons because of her hawkishness. Donald Trump is no answer. He's done he did something useful in attacking the neocons, throwing a baton at the establishment wisdom, but his campaign is one of insult, not strategy. So I'd say, you know, for Sanders supporters, work for Hillary Clinton, but you're working for opening up space for movements, for a progressive movement to grow after Bernie Sanders' campaign. So it's not just Hillary Clinton. It's fighting for that space to develop more powerful progressive movement and not have it shut down by a Trump.
Some of the critics of Bernie Sanders say, you know, look at his many years in Congress as a member of the House of Representatives and as a senator, and raise questions about what he has or hasn't accomplished, mainly saying, yes, he has these lofty ideas, but he has not been able to put them into any kind of effective, pragmatic policy. You described in an editorial Hillary Clinton as a candidate of no, we can't. Some people say I hate that phrase. I'm sorry to use that. Some people say, you know, that she represents a more pragmatic wing of the Democratic Party, basically saying, let's focus on the things that we can get done. How do you wrestle with that?
I wrestle with it every day.
Do you?
Yeah, absolutely. When I say no, we can't, we were referring to Hillary Clinton's, like, keep your head down. Don't think too aspirationally. She has moved. Again, I think Sanders' campaign has forced her to move to a stance where it's not just about competence and getting things done. I think people seek a sense of what could we do as a great nation if we could open up the space, not just, okay, this is what we can do. Mm-hmm. Keep your head down. So Bernie Sanders spoke, and let's be honest, you know, he spoke of democratic socialism. He spoke of revolution. What he is speaking of is a new deal for the 21st century. He is hearkening back to essentially great traditions in our own radical history. I had, of course, a great contributor to The Nation, Eric Foner, eminent historian, write an open letter to Bernie Sanders. Bernie had been going on about Denmark, right? Enough with Denmark. We love Denmark, but could we, like, retrieve our own radical history? We have a history, a free, higher public education. We have... No one is saying repeal ACA. We're talking about trying to become part of the Western industrialized nations with universal health care. Why is 15 minimum wage so extraordinary? It's passed in many cities and states. And it's also about a living wage, which Franklin Roosevelt spoke of. So I think, you know, we need to speak about what is possible, not tomorrow, but what we can build for through social movements and allies inside. I'm proud of an article we ran in 2008 by New York State's Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. He was then a New York State senator. It was about transactional and transformational politics. Yes, politicians must engage in the transactional, but to always do so with an eye toward how you game change, how you build something more transformational. And I think that is the balance. That is the balance. I will admit, we endorse Bernie Sanders. I endorse Bernie Sanders. I have had a T-shirt for 10 years, evolution, not revolution. But
you're going to have to move that R around, right?
You need that. I mean, some of it is a problem because revolution in we've seen it around the world globally through history, can be bloody. But Bernie Sanders was talking about a peaceful, nonviolent revolution, and it sparked the imagination. Marty, look at the young people. That is staggering, right? The millions of young people who were got engaged because they felt, here's something aspirational. Now, Bernie Sanders was also chair of the Veteran Affairs Committee in the Senate and worked with John McCain to craft reforms. He knows the give and take. He knows the give and take, and he has helped craft legislation through the years. Have we seen much legislative movement? I mean, the idea that Hillary Clinton would come in and get things done, look at President Obama. I mean, he came in, hope and change, wanting to get things done. One of my moments of grief about President Obama is instead of after 3 months giving him time, but when Mitch McConnell and his allies say their first order of business is to ensure that President Obama doesn't get things done as a one-term president, you give him 3 months, you work with them, and then you say, I'm moving on. It took a term. He's now into a different mode, President Obama. But I think he's been using his executive powers wisely. There's always concern about expansive overreach. But he had to. I mean, these people are obstructionists to the core.
That's Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, editor and publisher of The Nation. We are talking about the progressive movement here in Philadelphia, its impact on the Democratic Party, progressive politics, young voters, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. Lots of people that want to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel about progressive politics. Let me read an email from Kathy. She says, Hillary Clinton needs to show Bernie Sanders respect, ? She never said anything negative about him during debate. She turned to him and respectfully listened to his words. Sanders, on the other hand, gestured, grimaced, spoke over her in a very disrespectful way. He lobbed many low attacks, such as comparing her experience to Dick Cheney. Sanders never offered credible strategies, economic or coalition building that would assure successor to his improbable policies. That's an email from Kathy. When you talk about showing Bernie Sanders respect, are you talking about Hillary Clinton?
I was talking largely about showing his supporters the respect, listening to them. The most successful insurgent campaign in modern history has to be listened to. He won 23 states. Let me just step back for a minute, though, because I'll never forget, I think it was the first debate where Bernie Sanders said enough with Hillary Clinton's emails.
I remember that.
You know, Bernie Sanders is also a student of the media. Over his 30 years in Congress, he's been very critical of a corporate media which is more interested in conflict and sensation than issues. He had hoped that this would be an issue-laden campaign, and I think it was in many ways, certainly compared to the Republican Food Fest. So that was a measure of how we wanted to keep it on the high road. As these campaigns go on, you know how difficult it is with 24/7, 36/7 media demands. I think based on what I've heard from inside the campaign, a turning point was in the Michigan debate, or the debate on the eve of the Michigan primary, where Hillary Clinton alleged that Bernie Sanders had tried to sell out workers in the auto industry. It was much more complicated. The legislative path or the path towards some of these deals is much more complicated. And he may have voted something down because he didn't feel it did enough for the workers. He, I gather, was kind of thrown – he didn't have a good reply that night. Many people said, where was he? He seemed AWOL on that question. And I think he realized at that point that this was, you know, hard-hitting and the campaign was ready to go at him. So he amped it up on the Wall Street speeches. He has not raised emails. He has not discussed that issue. He's tried to keep it on a higher level. And our call in the last weeks, Marty, was for a campaign that began as an effort to take the high road on issues, to speak to the American people about why we can't have a real democracy until the grip of moneyed interests is loosened. All of those things on climate crisis, that return to those issues, Bernie Sanders, and don't get lost in the scramble for superdelegates. You know, revise that undemocratic rule at the platform if you can, committee. But I just feel that Hillary Clinton herself in that speech, victory speech, was saying, I'm going to listen to you, Bernie Sanders supporters, and thank you for making this a better campaign. So I don't think it's out of line. I think there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of thinking that there was sexism at certain times. I think there is an underlying sexism in the way women candidates are often approached in the media by their opponents. But I think sometimes it was over-ascribed.
Just a quick follow-up there, because I do want to get some more people in on the conversation about the superdelegates and many questions raised, not just by Bernie Sanders, about the role of the superdelegates in the Democratic Party. But nonetheless, he complained that they signed up for Hillary Clinton early, which they did. But now he wants to win them over. So it's confusing about how he feels about superdelegates. And I don't know, Katrina, if you have a quick answer to that or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, Bernie Sanders ran a campaign which was about taking on a rigged system. And the superdelegates became part of that rigged system at a certain point. I do think you go into the convention and you democratize the rules and try to end the grip of superdelegates, which were brought in, by the way, by the DNC to tamp down insurgent candidacies. But I think part of it is, Marty, that the Sanders went into this race to run a movement issue race, and what stunned him and his people was how well he did. And the campaign was achingly close to winning. And at that point, there was a reshifting maybe of the original mission. And, I'm not there. It's his decision. But I do think it's go back to the issues, run a movement campaign, fight for the soul of the Democratic Party, fight for the soul of the future of this of our politics. But superdelegates aren't going to be – it's hard to see how they would come, and they're not breaking for a lot of reasons. Hillary Clinton won more popular votes. I mean, she was strong. She dominated in many ways, even though he ran this extraordinary campaign. So keep to the issues. Keep to the high road. Fight for what you believe. Inspire your supporters. Ensure that the evolution revolution movement goes on.
Let me get Lonnie, who called us up from Malvern, to join our conversation. Lonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I just wonder what Christina VandenHeuvel thinks about the response Trump had today by preventing the Washington Post from getting credentials and how the media should respond. My reaction is they should all not cover him at all.
A boycott in response to what Donald Trump...
A boycott.
What do you think about that, Katrina?
Let me step back. And Donald Trump has no idea about freedom of speech, the First Amendment. This is not the first time he's attacked the media. He thinks it plays to his strength because of the mistrust of the media. But this is a man who had come into the White House making Richard Nixon look like Thomas Paine or Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president. The contempt for the role of the media as an instrument of public of accountability, holding public officials accountable, holding private officials, corporations accountable, is not on Donald Trump's radar. Your questioner speaks with anxiety, as we all should, about what this means. I mean, he's like a dictator who would imprison dissident journalists who he doesn't agree with. It could come to that. I think a boycott is not right. I think we need to think hard about how we cover Trump. I think there needs to be expressions not only of journalistic solidarity, but to ensure that it's not just about individual journalists or institutions, but about the role of journalism in our society. Donald Trump, I don't know if your listener knows, but his campaign has excluded certain reporters, has tried to box in and corral reporters. There's been an attack on journalists at some of these rallies. So I think it's a question we all need to think about. But I think boycotting him would give him more space and allow him to say, look at that media. They're kind of a institution that's not in the American tradition. They're not, we need to cover him, expose his lies, expose his intolerance, expose his contempt for media, First Amendment, free speech, independent judiciary.
Lonnie, thanks for the call. Here's another email, this one from Robert. He says, I love Katrina and her politics. Sanders would have won if he had presented himself as a New Deal Roosevelt rather than a Democratic Socialist. Please comment. I mean, we could do a whole hour on that because he is a Democratic Socialist, you know, not a straight just Democrat. What are your thoughts to Robert that if he had won more as a New Deal Democrat, would that have catapulted him over the top?
You know, I think he did a great – I mean, it is known, it has been documented that a generation, a younger generation, now is interested in the ideas of democratic socialism. What is democratic socialism? I mean, it's essentially it's a kind of New Deal. But I do think that it's still tough in this country. That word frightens some, not a younger generation, which is much more open to that idea. But in his speech at Georgetown last year, Bernie Sanders spoke of how his democratic socialism was in the tradition of the New Deal and in the tradition of American history. That speech got some coverage, not enough. But yes, in the same way Franklin Roosevelt stood in Congress in 1944 and read out the Second Economic Bill of Rights, go back and read it. It's essentially, with the exception of – it's Bernie Sanders' platform. And I think we've come – we haven't come a long enough way because Franklin Roosevelt was president and he wasn't driven out of Washington. If you gave that speech in the halls of Congress today or asked people to sign up, I think you see a marked difference post-Bernie Sanders, but some would say it's a subversive document. I disagree. But yeah, he could have run as in the tradition of the New Deal and, you know, 21st century. And it would have been – but he, you know, look how far he came. Look how far he came with democratic socialism as part of his frame and value and strength.
Let me see what Al from Fairmont has to say. Hi, Al. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was – when you were listening to the issues earlier, the one issue that struck me that was not listed was climate change. Bernie has put that at the top oftentimes of his agenda, but it's not very often echoed in the press. I mean, to me, if we don't start on climate change now, all these other issues will seem insignificant.
Well, I'll go ahead, Katrina.
Couldn't agree more. I think I did mention climate in the context of the New Deal, 21st century, adding climate crisis. I'll never forget, I think it was the first debate, where there was a question about the gravest national security issue. Bernie Sanders spoke of climate crisis, the urgency. I believe the moderator kind of mocked him. I mean, the Pentagon has issued a report that climate crisis is the greatest national security threat in 2020 or now. Bernie Sanders elevated that issue. He drove it. He has a very important spokesperson for that issue on his platform drafting committee pick, Bill McKibben, a founder of 350.org. And, you know, there is a difference between Hillary Clinton and Bernie on that. I think Bernie Sanders wants to end fracking. Hillary Clinton thinks you can regulate it. But Bernie Sanders, again, as he did on a number of issues which would not have been in this campaign unless he had run and elevated and driven those issues into the debate and the campaign, climate was one.
Let me read an email from Robert. He says, earlier in the program, it was stated that Bernie helped pull Hillary left. My question is, how legitimate is that change, or is it just a way to pander to progressive liberals for votes? And Katrina, in The Nation, you've talked about your concerns about Hillary Clinton and triangulation, you know, an old word from the 1990s. Do you share that concern from our listener?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what's important is that tell me a time in our politics, it's rare that you have a candidate who emerges sort of immaculately and picks up all the sort of important positions progressives agree with or, you know, name your movement. I think it requires social movements. It requires people organized. It requires collective action to demonstrate why an issue needs to be picked up by a candidate and endorsed and supported and followed through on. So that, you know, one of the problems when Obama was elected, too many people, I think, demobilized, believing that Obama would do the right thing. I don't believe, and I say this with humility, that anyone does the right thing without some collective pressure, action, media vigilance, And so I think we need to understand that, and it will demand continuing pressure and vigilance. On the military security piece, which I mentioned before troubled me about Hillary Clinton, I think this is a movement moment. We have economic justice, racial justice, immigrant rights, climate, others, but we don't have a strong peace, justice, diplomacy first moment movement. We saw something arise around Iran pushing and passing that important nuclear deal. We need a reinvigorated, revitalized peace and justice movement for these times.
Let me read two comments. One from Tony says, please, this is to you, please explain your optimism in the Democratic Party when history shows its establishment dating back to McGovern is regularly and systematically derailed and marginalized the very progressives who have pushed the party to convert its stated beliefs and policy. Then an email from Marge says, I admire Katrina and Bernie, but I'm sick and tired of the mean-spirited, grudging attitude towards Hillary Clinton's remarkable, tenacious march toward a historic victory over 25 years of Republican slime. This is coming from Marge. Misogyny is the water we all swim in. Hearing its echoes in liberal mouths is truly disappointing. Celebrate her flaws and all. I am with her. And I think that taps into the passions, the deeply held beliefs that you hear among perhaps progressives and people in the Democratic Party.
I think, as I said earlier, one celebrates the remarkable significance of Hillary Clinton becoming the first woman, a presumptive nominee of a major party. I think I respect the passion many people, many women have. I think it's a marker for our history. But at the same time, I also look at the issues, and I look at her record. And while she's an extraordinary woman, tenacious, I am deeply troubled by her foreign policy, national security stance. And I think that she is not fully, you know, she's not – think of Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton have been foes before. I mean, there was a view that Hillary Clinton was more supportive of Wall Street interests and – you know, supported some legislation because of that. But I think she should be respected. Misogyny has no place in any political, any system. We must fight it. I believe that firmly. I'm the first, you know, I'm not the first woman editor of The Nation. I'm the second. But there are not many, you know, there are not enough women. We know that even in Congress, in business, in media, running things. So that's vital. On Bernie, on the Democratic Party, listen, I am not optimistic. My optimism is a kind of belief that there is good work to be done and we can make change. I think that we are at a point where we've seen progress. Certainly, we've seen progress in progressives being more ascendant inside the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton wouldn't be advocating some of the positions she did today if the social movements, the political moment, and some of the forces inside the Democratic Party and independent political power organizations like the Working Families Party or National People's Action hadn't pushed her. So that needs to go on, but I think we are at a moment where we could see real progress.
Well, Katrina Vandenhoevel, there are many more people that want to join the conversation. Certainly lots to talk about. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. She's the editor and publisher of The Nation. She writes a bi-weekly web column for The Washington Post, and her blog appears at thenation.com. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. Carry on the conversation that we started on the air here on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We've got a second hour waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.